So the Great Purge, my friends, is upon us.
So I want to talk about free speech for a minute because Alex Jones, who is not my friend and who tells crazy lies about me, is thrown off Twitter, I think, and Facebook and a few other platforms. I think he's going to...
Thank God!
Well... If you're a liberal, you're supposed to be for free speech. That's free speech for the speech you hate. That's what free speech means. We're losing the thread of the concepts that are important to this country. Either you care about the real American shit or you don't.
Facebook, Spotify, and YouTube all completely banned InfoWars within 12 hours of each other, clearly suggesting big tech collusion and proving their terms of service are all bullshit.
Which basically means that for normie America, InfoWars doesn't exist. Now, the logic and reason behind this decision, which is obviously these corporations got together to do this because of pitchfork-waving mobs, based on, well, he's like a vast conspiracy theorist, he's hateful. No, he's not. Can you show me anything on these shows that you've banned that actually rises? Is it criminal?
They know there are lines, and they're scared of their own shadow. The tech execs come to Washington, D.C. with their tails between their legs, desperately trying to have these off the records with us reporters. What can we do to, you know, be more, you know, feeling? And they're squeezed from all ends. They're scared of conservatives because conservatives have these things, oh, they're banning, shadow banning us. And they're scared of the left because the left's saying, you know, clamp down on anyone who says anything offensive. And they're scared of their own shadow. They're in a crouch and they don't know what to
do. Except for that they do need to act to at least uphold their own terms of service, which is what they're
doing. But they keep changing.
They almost never point to specific videos or specific posts. Now, most likely part of their specific reasoning here is when you point to specifics, you create definitive lines in the sand, and so if you have a bad actor that's trying to abuse your system, they kind of know where to take it to the line and still get across what they want to get across. But at the same time, it would be nice to know what the rules are so you know if you are breaking them.
But they're not saying what he actually did. This is what's crazy. I keep hearing that he promoted the idea that Sandy Hook was
false.
Was false. And that it was a false flag, and that these were all actors.
Right.
I don't know if he actually said that. I think what he actually said was, I don't know if that happened. I think that's what he actually said. And people are saying, well, that's promoting the idea that it was a hoax. But I want to know if that's what he really said. See, I don't know if that's even the case, because I've heard it written that he promoted the idea that Sandy Hook was a conspiracy, but they're not quoting. When they say that, there's no quotes. There's no Sandy Hook was a hoax. Those kids were actors. Those kids are not dead. I don't see that anywhere.
Right.
But they keep attributing that to him without quotations.
But again, if there was some kind of process, due process, we could go back and look at the transcript and we would know this.
Not only that, if during this whole time where he's being tried, he was still able to be on YouTube and have his videos, he could show in his videos that he didn't say that. He could show what he actually said and tell you what he actually said and show clips. He can't do that anymore.
Now, iTunes and Facebook, they're private corporations. They can do whatever they want. They can make it up as they go if they want. I don't like it, but they're a private corporation. So if they decide that's what they want to do, well, they're a private corporation, and we don't have anything to say about it unless we make them into a utility, which is really bad. Now you've got the federal government deciding.
So here's what I say, Joe. We need to treat these as public utilities because they are, right? Facebook, there is no alternative. There is an alternative to YouTube. We need to regulate them. It's long overdue, by the way. And they are monopolies. It's obvious to everyone that they're monopolies. But, you know, when you invent something called WhatsApp and then Facebook buys it for $20 billion, there's a monopoly. There's no way to compete with these people. So these are monopolies. They need to be regulated, and people need to be protected. And that's where we need to go.
You know, there's this old quote: "Great minds discuss ideas, mediocre minds discuss events, and small minds discuss people." Something like this.
Yeah.
So now we have created the perfect medium for people to only discuss people and events, and to absolutely exclude the possibility of discussing ideas.
Indeed, like the character limit itself.
Yeah.
Takes care of that.
Yes. The character limit is not even, I think, the greatest limitation anymore. I think it's the attention span limitation, because we've gotten so used to this short message format of communication. is that our interpersonal communication across space, because of the increase of speed, there's been a corresponding decrease in depth.
What you gonna do? What you gonna say? Are you gonna try to have this your way? Well, everything you do depends on you. Say you wanna run, but you know you wanna play. Well, I see it in your walk, hear it in your talk. Say you wanna run, but you know you gotta stay. You know you gotta stay.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is August 19th. This week, we will be concluding the series with Skinner Lane and Moritz Behrling in two parts. I split the conclusion into two conversations. Today, you'll hear a one-on-one with Skinner. Later this week, you'll hear a one-on-one with Moritz. And this allows each of them to focus in on their areas of expertise in resolving this digital malaise we've been discussing in this series. If you are just joining us, there are two additional parts. Episode 570 is called Embracing the Infinite Game, and episode 571 is called The Deep Roots of the Current Information Crisis. This malaise includes things like fake news and information or input overload, social media fatigue, loss of privacy, lack of data ownership. And that relates to so much of what we've been hearing about over the last couple of weeks. I'm sorry I'm just getting to this. I was busy since the last time you heard from me, moving about 1,000 cubic feet of stuff from the Northeast, beautiful Eastern New Hampshire, to the gateway to the Midwest, the City of Champions, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And obviously, I'm not done with that project yet, you know? I'm sitting right now in an empty room that will one day be, hopefully the day will be this Friday, the new School Sucks podcast studio. So obviously, yeah, we're not competitive with the daily YouTube news shows or the daily news podcasts. But what I really strive to do with my show, if you're kind of new, is to, even when prompted by current events, create a product for the audience that is more timeless, dare I say, bigger picture. And I obviously have to say a huge thanks to Skinner Lane for helping out with that in this conversation. Skinner is the founder of Exosphere Academy. That's a learning and problem-solving community. You can learn more about it at exosphe.re. And a big part of our conversation today, Skinner is also the founder and chairman of Vaxios, which he is presenting as a potential solution to so many of the ills we're currently dealing with. I mean, let's remember, it was bigger than Alex Jones just in the last couple weeks. It was almost 2 weeks ago. He was banned from YouTube in kind of a coordinated effort from all these platforms. Since then, Stefan Molyneux suddenly got two strikes against his YouTube channel for not ancient videos, but older videos in what looked like a coordinated attempt to get his channel shut down. And my friend Jay Dyer had his WordPress account suspended just a couple of days ago. So these are just some examples of some things that should be pretty frightening. But the next two episodes of this podcast focus on solutions. I hope you get some value out of these conversations. I believe you will. Thanks so much for listening, everybody, and I'll be back in just a few days with Moritz. Take care.
You're simply gonna play, yeah, 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 yeah. You're gonna play.
So, Skinner, we spent a considerable amount of time in our previous two conversations outlining the problems that you guys are aiming to solve with Vaxios. I definitely appreciated the depth of those conversations. It went in a lot of unexpected directions.
Yeah, the subject of information covers literally every imaginable facet of human existence, because it's just the other side of the coin to the concrete formational world that we interact with. So it's very easy for discussions about information to sprawl into every direction.
Yeah, so, well, you know, I was trying to record a monologue for the second part of this series, and before I knew it, I had talked for like 55 minutes about my frustrations with like social media and input overload ills. So I wound up cutting it because I was worried the audience might be too fatigued by the time we started a pretty... I mean, that conversation that we wound up having was almost 2 hours, and I didn't want to burn people out before it even started. So it wound up as a separate audio. But yeah, it really got away from me once I just kind of opened it up to think about my frustrations. But today, we're going to focus in on Vaxios as a potential solution. And one of the names that we mentioned in our conversation a few times so far, Jaron Lanier, I wanted to start by asking you to clarify what Lanier's hope was for the internet originally.
So Lanier has been, I don't know, for the last several years, going back probably to I think 2012 or so, 2011, when he published his first book, You Are Not a Gadget, was sort of this manifesto trying to call people's attention to this Frankenstein that the internet has become in this so-called Web 2.0 era. A lot of people may not even be too familiar with the term Web 2.0 anymore, but when I was first starting out my entrepreneurial career in 2005, Web 2.0 was all the rage. And it really refers to the social media stack that we now kind of take for granted. At the time, of course, it was led by Facebook and Twitter, LinkedIn, and everybody was talking about the social and mobile web. And Lanier's point, you know, several years on from that time frame, is that it went terribly wrong. That we ended up with a world where the end user is the product and not the customer. Where the people that make our software have an incentive to engage in highly deceptive, manipulative user interface design, and we are sort of paying the consequence of that. I would say that one of the better metaphors, I don't think Lanier uses it, but one that I use is it's sort of like a drug that might on its own be kind of harmless, but then if you lace it with or you cut it with something very cheap, then it can suddenly kill a lot of people.
Right.
And we've basically been given a very, very dangerous, highly laced software stack. And the irony is not lost on me, but it's effectively just Skinner box manipulation. I'm, of course, referring to the behavioral psychologist B.F. Skinner, who I was not named after, just
right.
to clarify.
So can we say that, like, you know, 9 years ago when I started this show, I was saying, you know, some of you are too young to remember life before the internet. Now, 9 years later, there are people listening to this who are too young to remember life before Internet 2.0. So a sort of simple distinction is that Web 2.0 brings a user-alterable internet experience that did not exist. The internet was everything on the internet was what it was. And then with the advent of sites like Yahoo, where you could personalize your homepage, and then that sort of segued into MySpace, where you could become a sort of celebrity, at least for the 200 people you were friends with on MySpace, where, you know, you could outline all your personal preferences in music and movies and backgrounds and all that. And then it just kind of took off from there. But this is where the behaviorism that you're talking about is really kind of introduced into the web experience.
Right. This this whole Stanford feedback loop management mentality where people get, you know, literally into a digital hamster wheel and then suddenly realize that they've burned 3 hours of their day.
Yeah, absolutely. So how does the transformation from this current state into more of an information market address this problem?
So in the past, information itself didn't carry a cost, but the media that transported it carried a significant enough cost that that there was a selection mechanism for the quality of information that actually makes it out into the world. Today, it's quite popular to criticize gatekeepers, whether that's the media, traditional media, or book publishers, or something like this. And for sure, these gatekeepers definitely kept a tight lock on what is known as the Overton window, which is this range of acceptable discourse. but they also did perform a positive function that I think it's lost in a lot of the contemporary critiques, which is that they just kept out bad and like they might have kept out some good information, but they did also keep out a lot of bad information. And that bad information was excluded from discourse effectively by the cost of transmitting it. So the medium itself was expensive. The printing press was the first thing that revolutionized the marginal cost structure of transmitting information in writing. Prior to that, you had to employ extensive scribes to copy, to make copies of text.
Right.
And this is also what gave you this. It's important, I think, also for your particular audience. This is how we ended up with institutions of education, was that the medium of transport of information was so expensive prior to the printing press. And then even after the printing press, even though it was much cheaper, it was still very expensive. And so it made sense to congregate knowledge and information in one handful of centers of learning.
Right.
The main reason still today, the main reason that one should go to Oxford, for example, is the extensive library system inside of the Oxford University. Mm-hmm. Every college has a library. Every department has a library. You know, you have just lots of libraries, lots of books that you can't find on Amazon. Lots of books that are not in print anymore. And the internet has not yet fully replaced that. Like not all of those books are digitized.
Right.
So it's important to see that, that the cost of producing, the media on which information traveled, created a self-selecting mechanism for what information got to survive. If you go back and look at the things that were being published at the time of the printing press, you probably wouldn't be terribly impressed by most of it.
Sure.
And we don't know those books today because they weren't worth reprinting. The internet dramatic is an understatement. It so altered the marginal cost structure of the transmission of information that we cannot even appreciate how much our lives were changed in historical terms overnight.
Right.
In our local lives, it didn't feel like overnight, but by historical standards, this is an instantaneous transition. And it basically took place around 2000 when Moore's Law reached the stage where people could run software at effectively zero marginal cost. And this inflection point brought us the social media world that we live in today. I mean, if you go back to the 90s, the cost of transmitting a video on the internet was just extraordinarily high still.
Mm-hmm.
YouTube would have been impossible in the 90s. I mean, there were lots of attempts to do video on the internet in the 90s, but because of bandwidth limitations, but there were just hardware limitations. They weren't software limitations. But then those hardware limitations, the economics of those hardware limitations flipped around 2000. And so then, by the middle part of the first decade of the 2000s, you get YouTube being sold to Google. And that was kind of marks this transition point, even though fundamentally it took place a few years earlier. I would say that the YouTube acquisition was this like almost universal recognition that now storage and transmission is effectively free. And it's not strictly true because it does still cost Google a lot of money to run those servers, but those costs continue to decline day by day. So this is this background is important because prior to that, we didn't need a lot of extra mechanisms for limiting bad information. People did get a lot of junk mail, but they didn't get nearly as much junk mail as we get junk email. Certainly, if I needed to pick up a phone and call somebody in 1987, let's say, and they didn't live in my town with the same exchange number that I had on my landline, it would cost me money per minute. So we had all of these natural cost limitations to communication and information transfer, all of it. And then those costs got upended and we celebrated. Finally, information can be free. But there's no such thing as free. I mean, it's an economically nonsense statement to call something free. You can really only say that something is zero price. Right. That is, that the person consuming the thing doesn't pay for it, but it doesn't mean it's free. And a lot of people, you know, I had the unfortunate luxury of studying economics in college, and then there's it, but there, you know, and there, most of it is not terribly useful, but some distinctions matter, and the distinction between cost and price is a very important distinction from economics. So we operate in a zero price internet, but it is not a zero cost internet. There are lots of costs to using the internet, psychological costs, opportunity costs, and so forth. And because we don't have great information filters, and because we don't have control of the information filters that are there, we're just sort of like drinking from a fire hose. And sometimes the fire hose is spitting out kerosene or something, you know, and we are just drinking in the hope that something we want will come out next. And a lot of that is simply because there's no cost mechanism. It's sort of like if you go down to where a sewer duct is dumping into a river in some, you know, less developed place where there's not a good filtration system. If you sit there and watch all of the garbage and waste and excrement coming out of there and being dumped into what otherwise ought to be a pretty nice navigable river, that's about the best metaphor for the internet I can think of.
No, it's so lines up with what I was saying in this monologue where I was talking about just, you know, the surface current event stories like the actor Mark Duplass getting attacked on Twitter for suggesting that, you know, people on the left might want to check out Ben Shapiro. I don't know if you heard about that story.
Yeah, I did.
But, you know, I described it as, you know, like opinions form in people's head and then there's a place to defecate those opinions. So they do it. Right. And that's what Twitter has become, basically like a septic system, because so easy. It's like the democratization of information problem, too, where, you know, the bigger picture. And we talked about, you know, the significant pitfalls of buying into a democratic system of government. But in this case, it's very similar, where people, for the illusion of participation and meaning and impact, they seem willing to overlook the exploitative nature and even the destructive nature of the thing they're participating in.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot like it's quite analogous to the explosion of sugar consumption.
Yes.
When the marginal cost of producing sugar went to near zero, everything that is manufactured in the U.S. food-wise, you know, is just pumped full of sugar. And people are, in spite of the fact that they know this, it hasn't changed. Yeah, South Park did a great treatment of exactly what you're describing a couple of years ago, where on the show there was the invention of a new social network called Shitter, which used a brain-computer interface that directly linked up to the brain to just post all of your thoughts to the internet as you had them without even needing to type it, and they called it Shitter. And of course, they had Alec Baldwin and Cartman on Shitter, and you know it's quite hilarious, but it is sort of the reality that we're in. And you know, there's this old quote: great minds discuss ideas, mediocre minds discuss events, and small minds discuss people. Something like this.
Yeah.
I think it's frequently attributed to Eleanor Roosevelt. I'm not sure if that's the correct attribution or not, but. But, you know, so now we have created the perfect medium for people to only discuss people and events, and to absolutely exclude the possibility of discussing ideas.
Indeed. Like the character limit itself takes care of that.
Yes. Right? Yes. The character limit is not even, I think, the greatest limitation anymore. I think it's the attention span limitation, because the we've gotten so used to this short message format of communication. Nobody writes letters anymore. That's another interesting thing, is that our interpersonal communication across space has been, because of the increase of speed, there's been a corresponding decrease in depth.
Absolutely. enormous increase in overwhelm. I mean, I've thought about doing a show where I have a conversation with somebody who is doing finger quotes well on Twitter, right? Like, so Michael Malice comes to mind, who is very, very clever on Twitter and seems to really enjoy spending a whole bunch of his time there, mostly trolling people. And talking about how to even navigate that platform, the amount of information, even like related to one tweet, I don't know how people are able to follow that and all the nesting of comments, the amount of time to actually be able to have a meaningful exchange, if that is even possible. I don't think I've ever had one on Twitter, but I've never really tried.
Right.
The amount of time that it would take to go through everything that's there in a certain thread related to one tweet, it seems like it's a full-time job.
It is, for sure. And the problem with it is that it comes with the illusion that productive work is being done.
Yes.
Especially the American culture. Because it allows them to engage in mindless consumptive behavior and feel like they are fulfilling their workaholism social requirement at the same time.
Indeed.
And this is it has literally just hijacked the totality of culture. And we see the result of this. I mean, regardless of I certainly – you will never find me endorsing somebody like Hillary Clinton. But at the same time, I can't say that I'm at all a fan of the Trump phenomenon.
Sure.
And we got that mess that is not going to go away. I mean, I'm not talking about Trump himself, but the current political milieu arrived with social media. And just as a person with narcissistic personality disorder or psychosis is rarely likely to ask for help and therefore extremely hard to treat, our political discourse is sort of in the same sort of situation. Everybody says, I don't like the consequences of what we have, but I don't want to change what I'm doing. And this is really one of the things that motivated me to start Vaxios, because I don't think widespread change is going to happen unless it's served up to people on a silver platter. When I started out as an entrepreneur, I remember being very concerned about NDAs and all these kind of things, protecting ideas. Now I'm convinced that if you actually have a good idea, you are lucky if anybody will even listen to you, and there's a chance somebody will copy you, because the good ideas don't actually get copied, because good ideas don't ever seem like good ideas. And as a result of that, I think that without an extremely sophisticated approach to the problem that embraces and accepts the reality of the culture that we're in, it won't change. So the few people that are really speaking up and saying, hey, we need to change this, I mean, a lot of people are way too idealistic to actually do anything about the problem. And then other people are a bit too pragmatic in the sense of, okay, well, as I've listened to some of Jared Lanier's talks, he says, well, I just hope that Facebook would start charging, switch to being a paid platform. I think that's radical enough, because even as a paid platform, Facebook still is going to have an incentive to engage in algorithmic manipulation and put people in filter bubbles so that they'll continue to spend more time on the platform and then consider themselves having gotten the value of whatever their monthly subscription fee is. What I'm interested in is actually unbundling the whole informational transmission paradigm and looking at it granularly, the same way that we do with goods and services in the physical world. So if I want to sell something, if I want to sell a product on the shelves of Walmart, there's a lot of cost that goes into that process. You don't just show up to Walmart and say, here's my thing, will you put it on your shelves?
Right.
There's a pretty extensive vetting process before it gets to Walmart shelves. And that's actually really good for the customer. Because the people that are trying to sell things there to Walmart, have to put some skin in the game themselves. They don't just say, okay, here's our stuff, and then whether or not it sells the first round or not is irrelevant. Walmart also puts skin in the game by saying, okay, we're going to purchase this good and then take the risk that it will sell and so forth. Well, we don't do anything like this with information, not even close. We did in the past, you know, through these gatekeeper institutions and the cost of media, publishing media, we had something like this in the past. I think we should restore the parameters of that, but without the gatekeepers. And this is where distributed ledger technologies like Holochain and blockchain enable a whole new way of actually imposing these costs, but then allocating the economic benefits of that to the people that actually created the information rather than to the gatekeepers. And I think that's the major paradigm shift that we need in order to create a thriving digital middle class. We need for people to be able to make a living based exclusively on their digital life. Right. And today, a very tiny percentage of people who we call content creators are able to do that with extraordinary effort, but it's a tiny, tiny percentage. You know, they're out of all the people in the world doing podcasts, there are very few that are sustaining themselves with their podcast. For all of the bloggers in the world, we're talking about, you know, less than probably 0.1% of bloggers are making their living blogging.
Yeah, and the people who are really, really succeeding, like by the current standards with the current technology, they're often, I mean, we're hearing so many of these stories, like in the last year and a half, they're using platforms where they have, you know, an incredibly tenuous relationship, not just with the platform itself, but with access to their audience. I was contacted by this gentleman who interviewed me last year. He had over 100,000 YouTube subscribers. His channel disappeared overnight. You know, his content was more conspiratorial. He was definitely calling out Google and YouTube for censorship. But he woke up one morning and 100,000 subscribers and, you know, years of content vanished from the internet. So it seems like there's a trade-off right now, considering the platforms that are available to do this. I mean, Twitter is another one. You know, like if a person relies on Twitter for self-promotion and then they just vanish from there, I mean, maybe that, like people like Milo made it work in his favor, I would say, well, that's debatable. He seems far less relevant than he was, or certainly far less interesting and exciting than he was, you know, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. So, you know, I mean, I've managed to do what you're talking about doing, but on small platforms. That YouTube relationship always seemed very, very suspect to me. And, you know, once I got dinged a couple of times for copyright warnings or content warnings, you know, it communicated to me that I would not feel comfortable putting a lot of eggs in this basket, right? Even though the benefits up front look good, if I became dependent on that as a platform, things could go sideways very, very quickly for me.
Sure. And I would say that like the copyright system currently, the way that it's set up, it only benefits the large corporate interests. It doesn't benefit the average person, and it's so pernicious, the way Creative Commons has been more or less subverted by platform plays. I mean, this is also part of the problem that we're trying to solve, is that, you know, our copyright system is very, very broken. Our copyright system doesn't protect small creators, and it's very clunky. It's not easy to administer. If I create something and I want people to be able to use it, I basically have to give it away. If I want people to use it and I want to make money from it, the administrative burden of that is pretty high. With Vaxios, you know, what we're building is a system where, let's say that, you create some, you have a podcast, and I want to cut some segments of that podcast for a digest that I'm going to do weekly of podcasts that I listen to. Well, your podcast audio could be embedded with some code that if I cut from it, then when people pay me for what I'm distributing, you would automatically get your cut issued to you in a micropayment every time somebody pays for my content.
Right.
And like that's a copyright system that makes a lot of sense. And we don't need legal change for this because it could all be done with the right software and Creative Commons licensing agreements. You know, like we don't need to change the laws. We just need people to change their behavior. And software, I mean, software, the thing I love about software is it is a way to create the same net effect of changing the laws simply by changing voluntary behavior.
How so?
So, I mean, software is in a sense, whether we realize it or not, a private legal system. It constrains, like a piece of software constrains my behavior on a voluntary basis.
Right. Yeah. There's a sort of non-negotiable aspect to it, like with the law.
Right.
Now, I guess there's workarounds in both cases, like you can break the law or hack software if you know how. But obviously, yeah, you're right. It is creating a structure that most people are going to follow. And that initial relationship is voluntary because they choose to use the software.
Right. And one of the reasons that we're building on top of Holochain is that if somebody does hack, you would know it before you transact with them. If they've altered the headers of their chain of information. So this creates the ability to have a civil society mechanism for enforcing certain sets of norms around information and its transmission and so on. So, you know, for example, in the Vaxio system, if you want to post something to the people that are subscribing to your feed, let's call it, since that's language people are familiar with, let's imagine it's like a group, sort of like a Facebook group or a Yahoo group or something, these sort of things. In order to post something, the group can charge the person to post. So if I write a blog and I'm charging people to read the blog, I, of course, want a lot of people to have access to it. So I might go around and post it to groups for which I think it will be relevant. But the groups might charge me a fee. So then I'm having to do an economic calculation of, okay, do I think I'm going to get more money from posting here than I'm spending? So there, this group has 500 members. The group is about, let's say analytical philosophy. And I've written an essay about Wittgenstein. So I think they're probably going to be the kind of people that want to read my essay about Wittgenstein. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm charging, you know, let's say 50 credits on the Vaxio system to read it. And they're going to charge me 500 credits to post to their group. So I think, well, there are 500 members. So if 10 people read the essay and pay me 50 credits each, then I break even. So out of the 500 people, okay, yes, I think so. I think that's worth the risk. So I actually put skin in the game to take up their attention, to have access to that space. And then if they read the essay, then they if enough people read it, I make my money back, and then hopefully a profit. So the same kind of profit calculation that producers are making whenever they say manufacture shoes, the same kind of calculation ought to go into the transmission of information.
Right. So it's basically like gardening instead of, you know, not to torture this analogy, going to the bathroom in a place where a garden could be. But it also sounds a lot like the process that people who are already successful on these platforms or in this pursuit of getting paid for producing content, this sounds like the process of deliberation that the successful people already go through.
Yes, except that they're actually fully rewarded for it and not just thrown some pennies on the side by the platform. And I think this is one of the key things of breaking out of the advertiser sponsored model is that we're really calculating the specific value that the information is providing at the consumer level as well as at the producer level. So because I have to pay for information, like I might listen to a bunch of podcasts that I would never pay for.
Sure.
And the minute you ask me to pay for it, I might say, no, it's not worth that. Or depending on the price, if it's low enough, maybe it is. And then what this does is this starts to create a culture of putting a value on how people are spending their digital time. And if somebody wants to take some of that time, then I start looking at it as, well, this is, you know, a pretty precious resource. And I have to pay for this hour. Well, even though that hour is not free, like I have opportunity cost of listening to a podcast for an hour. I don't think about that cost the same way as if there's a number there that says this costs 50 credits. And so we have to create, like, really recreate the culture of discerning consumption and production in the digital world. And this is the only way to do it. There's no way that everybody who's looking for alternatives to the current system want to need it too. They want content to be free and they want the people that produce that content to be paid. Well, you simply can't. It violates the laws of nature. We cannot make something out of nothing.
Indeed. I mean, what you're saying sounds very promising, because so much of the process of exploration and learning and preparing to be successful with, you know, the current landscape, so much of it depends on pleasing Google. You know, like with SEO, right, what you're trying to do, yes, essentially is register according to Google's current algorithm, you know, the current desires of Google, basically, to get exposure for your website. So when you're talking about, you know, removing that, yeah, that's a super promising thing, I think, for any content creator to look out at.
Right. I mean, wouldn't you rather be working to please your listeners than pleasing Google?
Oh, absolutely. When I consider the resources that I've devoted to that, and, you know, how it's even made it difficult to produce content on a regular basis and question a lot of the content that I produced or that I want to produce, because it's not going to adhere to basically Google's expectation for an authority website.
Right, right. And would you say that you have had to compromise some of the content you would like to create simply to, and that, you know, your listeners would like to hear, but that you can't because of Google or Facebook or one of these mediating platforms?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been having conversations with people about, how am I going to get a bunch of this stuff off the website, or how am I going to make this stuff invisible on the website, because it sort of distracts from the silo system that I need Google to encounter, the little spiders from Google to encounter. Now, I mean, I'm not really complaining about this. I think this has been a very educational process, and it's actually made me more considerate of the work that I produce and the value that I can potentially create. But yeah, it would be nice to live in a world where I know there is a lot of content that I could produce that would bring a great number of people pleasure based on previous experience, that mm-hmm. now I'm, you know, really kind of hesitant because it doesn't fit into the bigger picture of what I think I need School Sucks Project to be, to rank for certain keywords and to be an authority according to Google on certain topics. But, you know, if that's right, the game, I mean, you know, the resignation, and again, I'm not complaining, but the resignation at this point is, if this is the game that I need to play to get this into, you know, the eyes and the ears of more people, that's fine. Right. And it's been an enriching process along the way, learning about how it's done. But sure, I'm certainly all ears for for another way at this point.
Right, right. And I think that this is really the place that almost all content, non-corporate content creators find themselves on the internet, but also even the corporate content creators. I mean, there are a lot of people that love Game of Thrones, but not enough to subscribe to HBO.
Sure.
So they torrent Game of Thrones. But if that content on a granular basis, episode by episode, were for sale with a system of frictionless micropayments, where I don't have to put in my credit card, I don't have monthly subscription fees, and I'm paying for it with the same credit system that I also, you know, make credits for my participation in the system, a lot of content that currently people don't pay for, they'd be quite fine to pay for. It's mostly the transaction costs, not just the monetary transaction costs, but the the user debt that's created by, well, I have to go create a, I have to go subscribe to HBO, for example. Eliminating that also means that we can get an explosion of great content that is not produced by large companies. So Netflix has built its business model on being paid, which the quality of Netflix content actually indicates that people are willing to pay for good information. The argument in maybe in the 80s before cable TV was ubiquitous. Who would pay for TV when they can get it for free? Right. And then even after, well, I'm already paying X dollars a month for cable. Why would I then also pay for Netflix? And yet here we see people will pay for quality. And but they need a system to be able to pay for quality. Netflix could not have gotten, like, Netflix, of course, didn't start by producing original content. They started by being a DVD by mail program. Mm. Their current business model wouldn't have worked 15 years ago.
Oh, sure. But one constant through the Netflix experience over the last, gosh, I guess they've probably been around for almost 20 years, is reducing friction. I always talk about these entitled millennials who never had to wait in line at Blockbuster Video. You know, I mean, you just remove that from a person's life experience. You know, the extra barriers and the additional friction in that process. So Netflix removed a ton of friction that ultimately was pretty instrumental in putting companies like Blockbuster, I think, out of business.
Right.
I'm pretty sure Blockbuster is out of business. And then I guess another way, too, is like if you kind of weigh barrier to entry versus the rewards of entry or the variety that entry affords you as far as content you can consume, you know, that's not really a difficult choice. I think I actually canceled Netflix, but I think I was paying like $11 a month to get access to pretty much, you know, an endless variety of content.
Right. Yes. And but here's the problem is that the people benefiting the most from that, well, the person benefiting the most from that situation is Jeff Bezos.
Right.
And you're probably benefiting, the customer, benefit the next most from that. The person that's not actually getting a benefit is the one that's doing most of the work, which
sure.
is the writer or the producer or whatever. And this is the problem with what Lanier is calling, he calls them the siren servers in one of his books. I think that that's still being quite nice. I actually think it is a digital cartel. So that, like, the cartels are making a lot of money, and you're better off than you were before the cartels arrived, but you're only better off as the consumer. You as the podcaster are not better off from this system if you're producing high quality content. And I like we just need the next step of the convenience revolution to apply as much to the people creating information as to the people consuming it.
So what do you think of current platforms that are attempting this? You know, not in the same way that you're talking about with Vaxios, but things like Patreon or Steemit.
I mean, I think that they are filling the need, an important need within people's current rough paradigm of freemium, but don't take the necessary pivotal step, next step, which is pricing information, creating a market. And a market is just a collective price-seeking mechanism or price discovery mechanism is probably the best way to put it. That a market is a collective decentralized effort to discover what is the natural price of something.
Okay.
The problem with, I wouldn't call it a problem, but I'm just saying the limitations of something like Patreon, the transactions have to be above a certain amount of money or, you know, it doesn't make sense to charge the credit card. Mm-hmm. And there's this, so like the number of people that I could support on Patreon is kind of naturally limited in a way. On the other hand, and this is where I really believe that micropayments are the only way to solve this problem. Because like a million people might be willing to pay 25 cents for something and 10,000 people might be willing to pay a dollar for the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in information, you have these very radical distributions. So the currencies that are used, like the normal currencies that are used to settle these accounts, are at least in the current payments framework, but also I think even in people's mentality, are limiting this creation of a long tail of producers that can make perfectly sustainable living on micropayments. I think that's the thing that really blows open the possibility of the internet, where I could, if I were, if I wanted to be a professional blogger, I could have thousands of readers paying me pennies,
right,
per post, without their user, without, there being a high user debt. That's going to open up so many possibilities, and possibilities for even kinds of types of content that haven't been invented yet. The medium, current medium, is really limiting even the possibilities of what can be created on the internet. But we have to first get rid of this transaction cost problem.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is one of the most frequent questions that I've asked myself as I look at the ways that people can contribute to the work that I do and help, support the spread of this message and support this mission. How can I make this process easier? So we're pretty successful with, a method that had a lot of steps. People had to make a user account on the website, and they had to have a PayPal, and then they had to sign up through PayPal, and then they had to communicate with me, and they got access to, not a Netflix amount of stuff, but they got access to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of additional content going back now 9 years with behind the scenes stuff of some of their favorite podcast personalities. It worked, but the friction was high. And then Patreon came along,
yes,
and reduced a ton of that friction. Like, Patreon is like two steps. People can get in at a pretty small monthly contribution. And it has really, really, Patreon created a ton of opportunities for this show. It was what allowed me to travel at the end of last year, across the country and back, which was a pretty significant cost. It has been a phenomenal addition to the support structure for the show. But of course, now that I see this, I'm saying, all right, well, how could this become even more frictionless?
Right. The other limitation with both Patreon and Steam, which I think you're about to mention, is that it's still pretty much one way.
Yes.
An economy has to be two ways. So in my view, these are information platforms, and what I believe needs to happen is actually the creation of an information economy, which we don't have. So by choosing a particular kind of content or format or payment method and confining that too much is sort of like trying to create a country with 500 people.
Yeah, sure.
If you create a country of 500 people and then you don't trade, you're not really going to get anywhere. And so what's really needed here is for the to have an information economy, which we don't have. People talk about the information age. We're not in it yet. We're just dreaming about it. We still live in a concrete world, physical world economy that is driven by an information layer, but it's not an information economy. What an information economy would require is for there to be a multilateral system of trade in information. So every user is a producer and a consumer, not just the people that post a lot to their blog. And this creator, I mean, the whole producer consumer distinction is this is a nonsense created by Marxism anyway. Everybody produces, everybody consumes,
right?
With few exceptions. I mean, we could get into the nuances of that and make comments about whether somebody's really producing based on their, if they work for government agencies.
Everybody, at the very least, is producing information for the internet. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, even if I never wrote a word on the internet, simply by liking something on Facebook, I am producing information.
Right.
I am providing valuable information to at least a few different parties. And so that, the value of that like may be extremely low, but it's still valuable. And so my view is that you can only create an economy out of information when you account for at a granular level, all of those interactions, the way that we account for at a granular level, all of the interactions going down to buying a pack of chewing gum. I mean, chewing gum may be extremely cheap from the perspective of marginal cost, but it still has a cost to produce. It's not free. You know, you don't go into the store and just pick up your free chewing gum. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't matter, great or small, transformative or mundane, information is valuable and it needs to be priced. And it needs to, and it has to be differentiated by price. Or you end up with a tragedy of the commons like we have today.
Sure. Let me ask you this question, and maybe I'm not thinking about this in the most complete way possible, but one of the ways that, you know, getting paid for the content you create on the internet works today, I mean, this is the basic model is you push market, right? You give away what you do for free.
Right.
You would attract an audience on that, and then some percentage of that audience would be willing to make a small contribution. I would say that in the history of me asking for contributions for School Sucks, it's come in slightly under 4%. But I know that other people are consuming that content and getting value, and maybe, you know, there's some barrier that people don't want to cross to, you know, raise that number above 4%. But what we try to do, all of us are trying to do, is build relationships with those people in the audience that we share our belief. We communicate our belief effectively that this is something worth investing more than just your time in. And I do understand that time is precious, and I certainly appreciate everybody who's willing to do that. But to keep this going, to keep providing that value that people get, yes, it costs money, it costs my time, and you know, obviously, yes, I do want to be compensated for that. So with the small percentage of people who agree and act on that. Well, I mean, the percentage of people who agree is larger. The people who act on that agreement is less than 4%.
Right.
With that 4%, we try to build a relationship with everybody, and then we try and strengthen that relationship with the sub 4% group, ultimately towards the investment in some kind of big ticket item, like a course or some kind of digital product. Right. Now, that is marketing, but it is also relationship building. I think sales are trying to sell something is very much a relationship building, a needs analysis, and making a recommendation kind of process. I don't think there's anything insincere or, you know, automatically manipulative about it. I think it's saying, hey, I have something. There's people out there who need this thing. And, you know, I learned this from the great email marketer, Ben Settle. You know, he said, look, if you believe that what you do is valuable, you have an obligation to yourself to communicate that value to as many people as possible. That almost overnight changed my attitude toward sales and marketing, which was something I always had a real aversion to. So if we transform into this information economy that you're talking about, do we run a risk for content creators of lessening the relationship or the tightness that they might have with an audience or an even more core audience because it becomes more of like, I don't know, just a buffet? You know, like anytime, like if I've gotten food at a restaurant, I'm really excited to get that food. But if I go to a buffet, I'm not like super excited about any one item. And I don't know if this is just my psychology or if you've kind of thought through this problem, like if people can just kind of pick and choose without really investing, you know, like we're talking about micropayments. If people can pick and choose without, you know, an investment of time and energy and emotion and ultimately money in one content creator, can we still have these strong relationships with our content consumers?
I think so. I mean, I actually think that they get better. It would be like if you had a restaurant, if you owned a restaurant, and you have your regulars, you have the people that come in once a week or twice a week, and you know them by name because they really like your restaurant. You know, you probably would be a very bad entrepreneur if you said, you know what, I like my regular so much that only you have to come to my restaurant two times a week or you can't come at all. Well, no, it's quite nice to get the money of the people that don't come twice a week, and it doesn't make you appreciate your regulars any less.
That is absolutely true. I mean, what we want to do is make more people into regulars, I guess.
And also just to get paid by all of the people that are eating your food.
That is true. No, that is absolutely true. You're right.
People are happy to do it as long as it's not too cumbersome. Like the number of people that will pirate a TV show is far eclipsed by the number of people that just pay for the content. And I think, you know, with platforms like Spotify are making a lot of money on people's desire for easy access to music. Mm-hmm. But the content creators are not getting paid for that. I mean, they're getting paid a tiny amount, you know, whereas for example, I'll give you a very great example of this. I'm a very avid pro user of Spotify. Mm-hmm. I have the paid version. I can't imagine life without it. I listen almost exclusively to classical music. And the reason I love Spotify is that it is this massive abundance of classical music. The sad thing for me about using Spotify is I know that the people that made that music are getting almost none of the money that I'm spending every month. Right. And that the money I'm spending every month is going to pop stars that I don't listen to. Mm-hmm. And so instead of my money going to serving as a price signal that somebody should produce and perform some esoteric arrangement of a obscure cello concerto, it's going to some vile pop star whose music I don't even consider to be music.
Right. And the reality of the situation is that those are the people who are probably making the platform viable right now.
Right. Right. And so I would really like to be able to continue to consume music, not necessarily at a flat rate. I'd be quite happy to pay, per song, either, you know, professional musician, I could make songs, pay per play or pay for, lifetime access to a track. So somebody could try out a track for very low micropayment and say, you know what, I want to have access to this song all the time, so I'll pay the higher amount. And then you get all of this stuff unbundled, like people that are paying for albums of music and they really only want one song. And the artist might be able, if they were serving up their music on Vaxios, to charge, say, $20 for a song, one song, mm-hmm. and 20 cents for the other songs, because they know that's what the market will bear. And they can continue to revise their pricing system according to demand.
Right.
None of that granularity of control over price is available to creators today. None.
No,
and
you're right.
They're put on these Procrustean beds and their legs are chopped off or their bodies are stretched to fit. And this is also what is partially responsible for monoculture, for the fact that everything is like everything else. There's no diversity because there's no way to get rewarded for the thing that is popular amongst a small niche of people.
Right.
It has to have mass appeal that can be sold to advertisers. And this is and it needs to be able to guarantee the eyeballs of particular demographics so that they can be sold some other thing. And I think this is what bothers me the most about contemporary consumerism is that everything is indirect. Nothing is just, I want this, I pay for this, I get it, period. Mm-hmm. Everything is these bizarre, circuitous routes to get the things that I want in digital space. And this just seems absurd. The fact that musicians probably, like the long tail of musicians, make more money on merchandising than they do on their music. And people are even told, give away your music for free and then sell t-shirts. No. Like, musicians should be paid to be musicians. If we like their music, we should pay for their music. If we like a writer, we should pay for their writing, not for their speaking tour. Because mm-hmm. it's the only way to, we can also pay for their speaking tour if we like to hear them speak. But, this idea of doing one thing in order to charge somebody for another thing is actually economically very inefficient.
Well, it's crossing signals.
Right. If we just put a price on everything, we wouldn't have a lot of the bad economic signaling. We would get more of what we want, less of what we don't want. That's what prices do. Prices give us always more of what we do want and less of what we don't.
Exactly. So can you talk a little bit about what the user experience or the user interface would look like for Vaxios?
Sure. So at the beginning, we are going to be approaching this primarily as a protocol that is then built with a sort of suite of plugins to browsers, for example, WordPress, which, of course, about half of the internet is published on WordPress.
Right.
So we're very concerned about the adoption curve. So users, like if you have a blog or a podcast or something like that, you'll be able to download the Vaxios WordPress plugin. Then users would need to have that plugin in, say, their Chrome browser, and then they can go to your site, and the plugins will communicate with each other to do all of the accounting. So it'll be very lightweight from the consumer perspective at the beginning. Eventually, we do hope to transform that into a more unified interface. But for the most part, we think that this is not a good way to nudge people in the direction of paying for information. If you just like throw people into a cold bath, they jump out very quickly.
Right.
And I think this is where a lot of the people that have had legitimate attempts to provide alternatives to Facebook, in particular Facebook and Twitter, have failed, because they want people to switch to their new Facebook.
Yeah.
And right. It's because of network effects and a lot of the things, it's very difficult for people to see the value of, because they're not going to just delete their Facebook and open this new thing. They're going to keep their Facebook and then add this other thing. And nobody, like, people aren't really interested in doing that.
Right.
So we're very interested in building the user experience in as invisible a way as possible. And on a very piece by piece basis, rather than trying to produce one of these like monolithic platform alternatives. And this is also going to give us a lot better data to improve the experience. And so we're taking a very, very slow iterative approach to building this out. We don't have this perfected vision of how it's going to look, precisely because we don't want to. We don't want to over-optimize it from the beginning. So we want to give people the subtle ability to start playing with the idea of pricing information, and then, you know, helping make that more robust. All markets, I'm sure there was some time in history where people maybe found it obscene to think about paying for food. And most everything that we now have produced on an industrial basis started out with people saying, oh, who would pay for that when they can make it at home?
Right.
And so it takes a while. And you have to go after the people that really need this ability, which I think is mostly in this long tail of creative, intelligent minds that are producing art or music or writing. I think that's where it starts. And I think that as those people start to adopt it, then other people say, you know, I realize that I'm doing some things that if I reoriented the way that I do them, I could make money at them, and maybe even eventually replace my income. People that don't even consider themselves today, they don't consider themselves content creators. They might discover that actually they are, and that actually is so valuable that they might not need their job. And I think that as you start having those cases in society of, I quit my job just to be an online content creator, and so you must be like basically an internet marketer. No, I'm not. I'm just doing the creation. Really? How did you do that?
Right.
This is, I think that's the only way this gets changed. And I think it will take years. I don't think it's going to, and I think it will be slow. I don't think that it will be, it'll be slow until it's not. And you never know when that inflection point hits. So we have a very grounded approach to it. Our ICO strategy for Vaxios is raising money to build software, not raising money to cash out. Unfortunately, that's what a lot of the ICO market has become. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're doing a lot of overly ethical things with our ICO. All of the founder tokens are going to be locked up for 2 years, because we really do believe in the software. We just want to bring the software to market.
Right. And it sounds like the approach that you're taking allows for more optimization, because you get more authentic feedback about each component that is built, right? And that it's not, right, as you said, this one monolithic thing. I think that's a really interesting approach. And, you know, as far as my interests and desires are concerned, I would say that, you know, for the length of what I've been doing, I've done a pretty good job of what you're talking about, like getting paid,
yes,
just for the creative aspect, while you know, I would admit to my detriment, given the current conditions, ignoring lots of other things that I could be doing. It wasn't until this year, the beginning of 2018, that I really, really started to focus in on this stuff. And that just because I became unsatisfied with the ceiling that currently seems to exist for me anyway, right, with my level of skill, right, and talent and knowledge. There is a ceiling for me personally that I'm looking to break through, just getting paid for doing the creative work, which is why I've re-strategized and started to look into these other aspects of making money, right, online. I love the idea of not having to do any of that stuff, but that's not the reality today. So I'm excited to definitely see the evolution of this and see what becomes possible for people like me.
I appreciate that. And I mean, it really is people like you that we are building this for, especially here at the beginning, because there are thousands and thousands of bright minds creating original information that touch people's lives, change people's lives. And they're doing it out of passion and public service, which is good. But even better if they get paid for it. I am not among these people that think that if you get paid for doing something, it diminishes the service value of doing it.
Sure.
I think quite the opposite. If we value something, we should pay for it. That's the honorable, correct thing to do. Everything else is sort of like free riding. So we want the internet to evolve into a place where people are happy to very easily pay for the great value that they are able to consume as a result of digital technology.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate the expansion on Vaxios and the future, the hopeful future of the information economy. Thank you so much for coming on the show and for your massive contribution over the last couple weeks. It has really been appreciated.
Well, thanks so much, Brett. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to continuing this dialogue in the future.
Likewise. Oh, if you're feeling small and you can't
saying that I'm just saying.